dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
All right, everybody, welcome to Maximum Film. I am your host today, Drea Clark. Do not fear, Iffy is indeed here in the virtual booth as my friend, but I have commandeered this vehicle to keep with the theme of a lot of our discussion today, because one of the reasons we are discussing Thelma and Louise, in addition to it being a 30th anniversary, is because this film, or this conversation, is being done in conjunction with the Bentonville Film Festival. For those of you unaware, I'm the film curator for the festival, which is led by Gina Davis, who appears in this movie. Whether or not if he saw her, we will figure out once we get to the discussion. But we are right about to hit the Bentonville Film Festival. It takes place August 2nd through 8th in Bentonville, Arkansas, but a huge portion of the festival is happening virtually. So many of you can watch many of the films at Bentonville, and you can do so for 50% off if you use the code MAXFILM at the Bentonville Film Portal. So we'll get into it. I just wanted you to know that you are in my hands, but everyone else's hands are also here. So let's get into those hands. Joining me, letting me drive, Iffy Wadaway. What's good?
Hey, what is up? Sometimes you like, you know, sitting in the passenger side, reclining in the chair, taking a quick nap on the way to Vegas, but waking up just in time and go, whoa, we got to make sure to stop. We get some of them ices, because everyone loves an icy on the way to Vegas. This is a big purchase week for me. Lots of great purchases have arrived today. If you follow me on Instagram, you know I went and finally got the Fellow Kettle. The kettle that lets you set the perfect temperature for your pour over. And, you know, you would think, okay, what is it? But the weight of it and the way it pours, you can really control your pour for great extraction, which helps because I got the Acacia, which is the industry standard scale for coffee. So now pour overs are great. And it's great because, like, I'll have these concoctions, my friends will come over, and then I'll make them a cup. And then they'll be blown away and they're like, okay, I get it. So if you don't believe that it's worth the hype, just come over and let me make you a cup. I got some Whoosh Whoosh coffee from Proud Mary up in PDX. So all that. Also, I got a stainless steel pan. So that's tight as well, because I've been trying to make some more Wagyu. And I ordered some fresh black truffles that I shaved and put on eggs and everything else I can. I'm a truffle head.
You absolutely just bragged about having a stainless steel pan. You were like, in your face.
He's a veritable Jean Dielman, that if he's
truly, you know? Right? Just peeling those potatoes and doing his pour over coffees.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, the person, of course, making the art house reference right out the gate is my sweet, sweet buddy, Alonzo Duralde. What is good?
Oh, well, I'll tell you, Drea, the Woodstock 99 documentary just dropped on HBO Max, and everybody's been talking about it. And, you know, I think there's some really sort of powerful revelations and observations in the film. Maybe some other parts that are a little less, you know, successful in getting the point across. But the movie opens with Litz, My Own Worst Enemy, a song I have not thought about in at least a decade and a half. And that song tears it up. Like, those opening guitar licks are just, you know, straight fire, as the kids say. And so I was just reminded how much I love that fucking song.
I saw Lit open for No Doubt at the Santa Barbara Bowl in like 1998 or something.
I think that would be the only year you would that sentence would work.
And the Black Eyed Peas were also there.
Yes, I was gonna, they had to be. I think it was like just a requirement.
No Fergie though.
Yes.
Purple the app stepped up and, you know, fun.
You know, the Black Eyed Peas. Actually, that's a lie. I do remember when I lived in L.A., Black Eyed Peas were like a cooler, like hip hop trio for a minute. and then they leaned pop.
Yeah, but it was like such a clear arc where it was like they did pop and then they were really popping and then they were, you know, getting it started, we'll say. and I'd say I say at that point is when they jumped the shark.
Oh my God. Getting it started.
They became very popular at bar mitzvahs.
Yes. I think it's important to note that our guest today did a full on like trucker pull your horn, like full body insignia with excitement over hearing about Lit, which tells me, yes, indeed, she is the right person to be here. Friend of the pod, and the pod is a fan of her, film critic Katie Walsh. What's good?
Hi. What's good is that I'm here and that I obviously couldn't wait to be introduced before I had to interject about seeing Lit
as a teenager.
So you totally Dre'd that one.
Yeah.
So that's good. I also really want to hear about this kettle because I'm also a pour over coffee girl. So drop a little link in the chat and I'll see what if I can order it.
I can say definitively that in this whole Zoom, I'm the best pour over artist. That there's no one here in this Zoom that can do pour over better. I don't have a scale,
so you are upping me on that one.
I'm just a Mr. Coffee, so I'm not even in this race.
I don't drink coffee, so I'm not even really sure how pour overs are made, although it sounds like it's right there in the title.
I'm teasing super producer Casey because he worked at Intelligentsia. And so he's.
I know. I'm not supposed to talk because I'm not in this episode, but he's talking about me and it's false. And I just wanted to say that real quick. Continue.
Drea, what's good?
Thank you, Alonso.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Oh, my gosh. This is what it is on the other side where I got to flip it. I'm usually the flipped E.
Yeah. You're like, hello. I'm right here. Okay, well, what is good with me is Simone Biles.
Yeah,
I am a big fan of American hero and U.S. gymnast Simone Biles, who, where we are today, has now, she's scratched from the all-around team competition, and she has now bowed out of individual competition, prioritizing her mental health. And I am very heartbroken that is a decision that she had to come to. Obviously, I would love for her to be able to compete in the sport that she loves at the full extent of her abilities and really shine on such an international stage. However, I can't even imagine the pressure she is under now, has been under for a decade since a small child. She's still a young woman. Like the enormity of it mind boggles me. I remember how stressed I got, like, moving to LA and having to get a California license. So yeah, anything like beyond that seems incomprehensible. And I think that what this teaches young kids who are either athletes themselves or just competitive in other ways, like academically minded, whatever it is, I think it's such a big cultural moment for us to have. And of course, you know, there's the legion of shitheads with their stupid takes on this. But you know, they're shitheads. So that's the shitheads gonna shithead. So yeah,
that's par for the course. Like I was gonna originally be like, if you follow sports on Twitter, but it really, if you follow any skilled activity on the internet, you could see there's a whole bunch of people that would never be able to do it that have lots of thoughts on how they could do it better. And it just never gets old. It never, like, it's just like inescapable, and it really stinks that, you know, she has to deal with this. But I do like the fact that you're right, you know, it teaches, you know, kids that, you know, it's okay to take a break. And I mean, if we want to do this apples to apples thing, you have, you know, Michael Jordan retiring all the time, Tom Brady deflating balls and retiring. So, you know, you have, it's not even like this is something unique. I think, you know, it can really bubble over. And then on top of this, this is the most scuffed Olympics ever. I think at this, you know, like at this point, you know, it's over there. So I can kind of talk about it. I was like originally going to go over there and cover it for Twitch, but then, you know, I got this writing job, which is dope. But like, I've been following it closely, and just every single thing that comes out about the Olympics, you know, not even getting into like how the Olympics displace, you know, the impoverished people in the country, but just every step of the way and not really taking this whole pandemic seriously. I can't imagine all that leading into this and then doing it. Like, I can only imagine getting there, not even having a crowd, and then being like, this isn't worth it. This is, you know, this is.
Yeah.
That's the Olympics are a corrupt shit show, and we really need to take a strong look at why we care so much and what we're forcing athletes to do and what happens to, you're right, the people who get displaced every time that a country has to build new facilities and all the stuff. There is a lot rotten about this thing, even though, yes, the glory of athletic competition and the sports people are fine. It's the organizers who are a nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, I just love that she's allowing us to talk about how mental health is medical health. It's a medical injury. If you're having, you know, a mental health issue, she could catastrophically injure herself if she does not have her head in the game. I mean, the things this woman does is so out there, difficult, crazy. Like, she would, I mean, she's putting herself in danger if she doesn't have her mind right. And like, absolutely. I was reading all these threads about how in gymnastics, if your neural pathways are like not connecting correctly, like it's called the twisties. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And you can't function. You're going to hurt yourself. And I think we've seen so often these young gymnasts like pushing themselves physically and like, we need to stop. It's abusive. We need to stop, you know, doing this to these young girls. And, you know, mental health is physical health. It's all one. And I think that as much as, you know, there are shitheads out there saying stupid things, we're having these conversations. And so I appreciate the fact that she's allowing us to have these conversations that I think are really important and overdue.
Yes. Also, I'm still watching other stuff. Did I watch kayaking? I did. Did they not fall out like iffy? They didn't. So, you know, the Olympics.
I mean, you probably were only looking at the highlights. I'm sure the fallouts were.
I'm sure someone pulled an iffy, as we call them. All right. So today we are going to be discussing Thelma and Louise and whether or not twisties were involved in any of their shenanigans. We're going to be chatting more about the Bentonville Film Festival, and we will be giving you our staff picks. But first, it is time for our news segment, It a Dick, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the questions, Is This Important? Do I Care? Let us start with Mr. Sean Penn. According to Deadline, actor Sean Penn refuses to return to the set of the new Starz limited series Gaslit until everyone on the production gets vaccinated. He has also offered the use of his nonprofit CORE, which stands for Community Organized Relief Effort, in order to provide free vaccinations for everyone on the production. Is this important, and do you care?
Boy, howdy, yes.
Yeah, this is very important. Also worth noting is, SAG has officially come out and said that, you know, only vaccinated actors are allowed on set. I think we're kind of moving to that point where it's like, okay, we're going to push the needle a little bit. We're going to try to do
as it.
Literally.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I can't believe I missed that great punt.
I mean, you said that.
Yeah.
Alley-oop, slam dunk.
Oh, yeah.
Sports.
That was good. Yeah. We are space jamming right now.
We are.
Netflix also has said that for all of their U.S. productions that actors and close contacts will also need to get it. So, yeah, I mean, it's just I frankly want to have to show my vax card everywhere I go. And I certainly would want to do that at work if I'm at work on a set with the dozens and dozens of people who are going to be there handling food, putting makeup on me, touching my hair, whatever the things that go on in making, you know, TV and movies. I think that's an absolutely fair and rational thing to do. I mean, yes, we've seen a ton of testing going on and sets closing down when there are positives. But like, there is a vaccine. We should all be doing it.
But imagine like they wouldn't have to shut down. And then they wouldn't lose all this money and time and all of this effort if they just got vaccinated. I mean, hopefully they wouldn't have to shut down, but it would greatly decrease the risk of that happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sean Penn himself is vaccinated already. I think that's an important angle for this. It's less like, oh, I want everyone around me covered so I can do whatever I want. That's my Sean Penn. but he's not
dead
only
on.
That is, that his organization was behind like transforming Dodger Stadium here in Los Angeles into like this enormous testing and vaccination facility. So I think it's of import to him anyway, but I think it's, you know, it is that thing of looking at your overall work environment, and we are at this absurd state in America where we're a rare country that has more supply than demand. Like the fact that we've had to shut down so many of these big places because they just started to trickle down, and yet we're still not yet even to 50% countrywide. So I do think that we're going to see more and more industries looking at this because there's monetary angles of it, which is obviously what corporations are always going for. But you know, if it adds to just a sort of sense of urgency or whatever, I'm all for it. I feel like the work at this point needs to be done by the people who are not yet vaccinated and can be because they don't have medical issues or whatever not. And most of them do not. So, yeah.
Last week, we reviewed Space Jam, A New Legacy without Iffy. But put a pin in that. We'll be getting right back into it. We didn't all hate it, per se, but the same cannot be said for original Space Jam director Joe Pitka. In a recent interview with TMZ, Pitka ripped the new film apart, saying it took him 5 different attempts to watch the entire new film. He also said of LeBron's performance in comparison to Michael Jordan's, "The truth is that LeBron ain't Michael." He also insulted the soundtrack, calling it insignificant, and he said that Bugs Bunny looked bad in the film, quote, like one of those fluffy dolls you buy at an airport gift shop to bring your kid when your business trip has taken too long, unquote. Is this important? Do you care? And Iffy, your thoughts on Space Jam, A New Legacy?
This is whatever. This is just salty because, one, Michael Jordan was not a great actor. Two, you have a raving sexual assaulter as your main song of your movie, so you really can't talk. I would just stay away from the con because he was no known sexual assaulter at the time too.
It's maybe not like it was bring up the soundtrack.
That's you just don't. And three, it's like the animation. He was right.
The 3D Bugs Bunny in Space Jam: A New Legacy, I physically recoiled. I was like, when they'd go from the 2D bunny to the 3D bunny, it was one of the most horrifying things I've seen in a movie theater this year.
I didn't even blink. I was like,
fur and feathers, no thank you.
Yeah. No, it was awful. Yeah. I don't like that one. I don't like that Bugs Bunny. Yeah.
Oh, no, sir. I think that Pitka is such a like grumpy old man yells at clouds. That is very much the energy of this. Also, he, of course, was attached to direct Space Jam 2 forever, and it never came together. And so I'm sure it's his
if they'd made him like a producer in some nominal way where
he'd be out shilling the hell out of this.
Absolutely, yeah.
He's made approximately $80 billion as a commercial director. So like he hasn't done any other Space Jam was the last feature he did. Previously he did in 1989 Let It Ride with Richard Dreyfuss.
I've heard good things about. I've still never seen it.
Fine. He's like the most generic, big money, Super Bowl commercial kind of director. And the idea that this is the movie, he's like, how did you do this to the grand legacy of Space Jam?
Yes.
I just want to know, like, if this was a TMZ interview, like, I want to know the circumstances of it. Was it like, you know, were they accosting him outside of a restaurant? Oh,
that's what it feels like. He's sitting there waiting for a pasta, and someone's like, hey, I got a big cup. What do you think?
They both said while he was lashing all the way to the bank. not to relitigate Space Jam: A New Legacy, but we do need to know, is it going to go into the Ifechukwudi collection?
No, it's not quite classic material, but honestly, it's not the fault of LeBron James. That's also one thing I want to say. They're like Michael Jordan, they didn't trust LeBron James. They made the Monstars actual athletes, which made them a bigger part in the movie, unlike in the first Space Jam where like Charles Barkley and all of them were kind of like the side, like it was a cameo more so, but Jordan was this main guy. But then you have like all these, you know, I think it was just too much basketball. I think you needed just LeBron, just the tunes, and just some more beefed up tunes to go up against them. Like those were some Thicked up tunes in the original Space Jam.
I don't feel comfortable with these words.
Thicked up tunes.
More beefed up tunes.
Here's what I will tell you. I will give the one thing that I will give Pitka credit for is that that first movie had a very unexpected and very welcome scene where Michael Jordan was shirtless. And I did not get that with LeBron James.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will resent that for all of my days.
I know. I know. That would have been my first note on the script is like, we need moist LeBron James chest. He had all the great tats. It would have been a great scene. Probably would have bumped it up a letter grade for a lot of critics.
At least half a star. At least half a star.
So keep that in mind, anyone who's planning to work with LeBron in the future. All right, let's close this up, lest if he use the word moist again. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will be talking about Thelma and Louise.
Prepare yourself for the greatest pro wrestling podcast spectacular known as Tights and Fights. A fact-driving audio showcase that helps you understand the world of pro wrestling with a lot of love and no toxic masculinity. Featuring host Danielle Radford.
Time to kick butt and chew gum, and I'm all out of butts.
Lindsay Cal.
I'm a brutal Brit, and my fists were made to punch and hit.
And Hal Lublin.
I was doing the voiceover this whole time.
Hear us talk about pro wrestling's greatest triumphs and failures.
And make fun of its weekly absurdities.
On the Perfect Wrestling Podcast.
Tights and Fights. Every Saturday on Maximum Fun.
All right, buddies. Storyblocks makes it possible for creators to keep up with the growing demands for modern video content, so you can bring all your stories to life and stop sacrificing your vision due to time, budget, or resources.
Storyblocks' unlimited all-access plan gives you unlimited downloads of the more than 1 million assets in their library. You can try out multiple options quickly and find the perfect fit so you can create more and spend less. Restock is their commitment to increase representation in stock media by hiring creators from marginalized communities to create content that is more reflective of the diverse world we live in. Stay on budget while telling the best version of your story with the most affordable subscription plans and tools on the market that scale to meet your needs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these are great, great options and items that you can all get. And I can tell you how important it is because, man, as someone who has trudged through stock sites searching for black faces to represent me in memes and dumb PowerPoints I've put together, but also just for filmmaking stuff. We've used it on the pod before, and you need this. It's great. I can't recommend it enough.
He can't and he won't. Now you can explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/maxfilm. That's storyblocks.com/maxfilm.
All right, let's get back to it.
And welcome back to Maximum Film. I continue to be your host today, Drea Clark. In the virtual studio with me are
Ify Wadiway,
Katie Walsh,
Alonzo Duraldi.
That's the first time Ify got to do his
I know, I was,
his
I said
like
it with
that.
A smile on my
you
face.
You did so good. You said your name so
yeah,
good,
yeah.
Guy.
I'm feeling it.
Today we are talking about Thelma and Louise for its 30th anniversary. Unbelievable to all of us, especially those of us who think they're ageless. Me. Katie. Can you start us off with a brief synopsis of the film?
Of course. And I just rewatched it. It's fresh, hot and fresh in my mind. And also, this is like, I don't even know how many times I've watched this movie. I literally clapped and cheered at the end like I always do. It just gets me every time. But Thelma and Louise is a road movie. It's a I accidentally killed someone movie, which is another one of my favorite subgenres. It's a bestie movie. It's a feminist Western. I mean, it's such a great genre mashup, but it's written by Callie Corey, directed by Ridley Scott. It stars Susan Sarandon as Louise and Gina Davis as Thelma. Louise is this like savvy diner waitress and Thelma is this, young, naive wife. And they are going to go on a fishing weekend together. And Thelma, who's very sheltered, insists on stopping at a really sketchy like roadside. Like they were pulling over to this truck stop. I was like, I wouldn't stop there, but you know, whatever. So they stop at this roadside tavern. They get really drunk. They're having a good time. They're letting loose. And Thelma is flirting with a guy named Harlan, who takes her into the parking lot because she's very drunk and he attempts to sexually assault her. And also, you know, Chekhov's gun, Thelma has dropped her little lady pistol into Louise's purse. Louise goes outside to find her friend because she wants to hit the road, and she stops this rape from happening. And then Harlan's like, suck my dick, and she shoots him.
Yes.
Anyway, the girls go on the road. They hit the road because Louise doesn't want to go to the police. And of course, this spirals out of control. They run into Brad Pitt. They have sex with Brad Pitt. Well, Thelma has sex with Brad Pitt. They rob. Oh, he robs them. They rob a store. Harvey Keitel's trying to find them. And they're just on the road and they don't know what to do. And finally, there's this huge standoff in the desert. There's a helicopter. They're on a cliff. And they're just like, fuck it. Da, da. I had fun. I'm not going wherever they're taking us. And they just floor it and drive that Thunderbird right into the Grand Canyon. And it is like the most triumphant suicide you could possibly imagine. Of course, we don't see the car crash. It just stops in midair. It's like
we're all Fast and Furious fans here, so yeah. If you ask me, that Thunderbird made it to the other side. Yeah,
right.
No
there
problem.
Was a jet with a magnet,
100%,
and it scooped it up right 100%. Into the cargo hold. So yeah. and Charlize Theron was driving the jet. So well, okay, they're on the off, feminist jet.
Please write this all down for me, Katie, because okay. I will enjoy okay. this deep fanfic later.
Yes.
Yes. So as mentioned, this movie. We will be getting into in all its nooks and crannies because it's 30 years old. We can't be responsible for spoilers at this point.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Am I the only person in this Zoom chat to have been old enough to see an R-rated movie in 1991?
No, I was not so. Old enough.
Yeah, yeah, I was not
sorry,
old enough.
Sorry, dude.
Okay. Just checking.
I got to say, technically, this was my first time watching it the whole way through. Like, I've seen bits and pieces, but okay.
I'd love to hear where is everybody coming at with this? Like, this was Iffy's first time. I'm sure you've seen, like, bits
yeah.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you
I
know
knew
the
what
ending?
Was going to happen. Yeah, oh, I knew, okay. Which honestly, knowing it made me angry the whole time, which we'll get into.
I saw it. I saw it when it came out and loved it. Like, it is a thing for me where there are movies that I love that I will watch over and over again. And there are movies that I love so much that I will never watch them again because ooh. I feel like the experience was so sort of sacrosanct in a way that I don't want to mess with it. I don't want to revisit it a few years later and find out that maybe it's not as great as I remember. So this was the first time I had rewatched Thelma and Louise in 30 years because
whoa.
I was a huge, huge fan of it when it came out. I had a t-shirt that I bought at a lesbian bookstore in Dallas that said yep. Thelma and Louise Live Forever that had like with their picture on it.
So you already predated this whole fanfic scenario.
Oh, totally.
Good.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's the lesbians are always as ever ahead
as
of
ever.
The curve on this. I fucking love this movie. And
so how was it rewatching after 30 years? Were you it's so great?
It's still great. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And I definitely it allowed me to sort of notice things because, you know, I think, again, it's sort of that thing of like, you know, when you if you got to see Psycho and it was theater in theaters, like what? Janet Leigh gets killed. You know, I did not know how it was going to end. So that was something, you know, that was like unexpected. Like, wait, do I love this? Do I hate this? Wow. What? But of course, that's the only way it can end. But watching it again made me realize like. The way they sort of like there's the film kind of hits this moment where they understand what's going on and they understand that there's no way out of this. You know, there's this great scene later on where they like stop at the little gas station in the middle of nowhere and Susan Sarandon gives all of her jewelry to the old guy in exchange for his hat. And it's like, okay, that's somebody who knows they're about to die. That when you're giving away your valuables, like, you know what's going on. It was as good this time as it was the first time.
I remember seeing it around the time it came out, or definitely young enough to enjoy it, not enough to really take on how much nuance there is in this. And then I saw it again at the 25th anniversary, the Hollywood Forever, the cemetery in LA that does outdoor screenings, did a screening that both Gina and Susan came to. And, but you know, you see things like outdoors that are dry, you're not fully paying attention to something. Rewatching it this time with the intent to analyze to the point that we could discuss it, there was so much of it that I'm like, this is laying out so much beautiful character work from the very beginning, like Louise's rigidity, her whole hair story, the whole journey of her hair being tightly wound and then loosening up, and then Thelma's ending up being, you know, pulled back, like just the whole thing. But from the second that Thelma is first accosted and Louise finds her, when I rewatched it now, I was like, oh, this is a woman who knows assault. Like it was so much, I was so more acutely aware of that than I was when I was younger. And watching how the idea that I had of the lives these women lived and how much those lives were completely hemmed in by circumstance and either by what they looked like, how they were treated. Thelma is in a very abusive relationship that is so accepted that they just sort of joke about the fact that her husband's an idiot who hits her around. Like it's so baked in terms of the full extent of what their lives could be. And the other thing, and I'm so glad Katie brought up the genre mashing, is you guys remember I had in the fall, I watched like 60 Western films. Mm. I went on a whole Western thing and I had never realized how much there are parallels of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in this. All the way to like ending by, you know, choosing your own death in this very dramatic way, you know, like, but that's still not shown. Like so much of it there, I was like, oh, this is how they set women in a Western in the 90s. Yeah.
It was, and I love that they use that setting of the, you know, what you would think to be like a John Ford type like setting.
Monument Valley sort of.
Kind of Monument Valley looking. And it's sort of like re-inscribing the Western iconography as this like place of feminist liberation. And so I love that that's also like a reference that you can make with that film. And I was going to say about the character work that they start setting up so early. One thing I noticed on this rewatch is like the way Louise, when she's getting ready to leave for the trip, she sort of like carefully dries a cup and like puts it on a little dish towel. And you're like, that's so fussy. Like she's so fussy and kind of clean and neat. And then she's giving away her jewelry at the end. And, you know, you can tell this is a woman who thinks she's coming back to her house and cleaning all her glasses.
She's a woman who owns 20 snow globes. She has a single glass and 20 snow globes. Right. Like the small things that even the set dressing are doing to try and tell us who they are.
The set dressing, the costuming, like the costume and hair journey that they go on.
The fact that Thelma, like everything she owns at the beginning has like a ruffle on it somewhere. And by the end of the movie, she's just wearing like a sleeveless t-shirt.
I love their outfits at the end.
You know, seeing their evolution is great. I think that's why, like what I hinted at earlier, is I get so mad at the ending because I feel like, you know, I by the point I've seen it, you see so many movies where you get to see people who did a bad thing but can redeem themselves, and then that you see these. Like, one, this movie feels like it's very ahead of its time. Like, I think just the simple line of, like, we can't go to the cops. You were up on this dude dancing. They're not going to believe that you were raped. And so, like, to have them, like, you know, have this growth and you see them, their friendship get stronger. And then at the end, they got to die. I'm like, but I want them to live forever. I need them to live life as these new, like, them.
Yeah.
It feels like this, like, this blooming that gets shut down.
The movie isn't punishing Thelma and Louise. The movie is punishing the patriarchy.
I agree, though. I think that there is something like I get their decision and I think it's earned. Like, I think that they do such a good job of planting. Also, when I talk about like the limitations of life that these women were subjected to, like they also know the reality. Like one of the reasons you get the sense of Thelma putting up with her abusive husband that she's been with since she was like an early teenager is No one cares what happens to her. She's never once been protected by the system. Neither was Louise. It's why she doesn't want to report this in the first place. Like, to them, they already know how it will end. If it doesn't, I'm with you. I would have loved a sort of, I'm like, yes, get all weird magical realism in the last 20 seconds of this
have
thing.
The roof of the convertible act as a parachute.
Yeah. Yes, I'm fine. Yes, bring in Looney Tunes nonsense right then. Yes. But like that I would have welcomed, because it's also the idea of glorifying that kind of choice is definitely hard to swallow. But I do think that it's built into what these characters' mindsets are in a way that feels more right to me than if it was just like people who hadn't given me any idea of why they were doing that. And then it was just this, oh, we're going to do this big ending like this like shock and awe. Like this felt...
Oh, yeah.
Thoughtful, at least.
Yeah.
What I like about this movie is that, like, I love when the internal logic of a movie works, even if it doesn't necessarily translate to, like, the world that we live in. But the morality of this movie is completely on their side. Like, we see how horrible Daryl is to Thelma. Mm-hmm. We see, you know, how horrible that assault is. Like, it's, and it's everything they do is justified, even though when she shoots him, it's not exactly in self-defense. But like, even the waitress is like, you know what? He deserved it.
And somebody was going to do it one of these days.
Yeah.
And then even Harvey Keitel, like, he's yelling at Brad Pitt for robbing them. And he's like, those girls wouldn't have robbed unless you took their money. And they had a chance. And now you're taking away their chance. And like, you can tell he's like rooting for them. He just, and you know, he's the lawman who's trying to catch them. But he's like, he knows the situation. So like the whole moral code of the film is like on their side and justifies what they do.
And it's so welcome that Harvey Keitel's character is doing that. Like if you didn't have that, it would feel very like all men are bad, all women are victims. And instead, you know, you have this man who's like, I'm on the outside. I see where you're coming from. Like each stage of the way, he has a sense of what they were going through. But they also make this very bold thing, like the inciting incident, Louise shooting Thelma's would-be attacker, it is not in the heat of the moment.
No.
It is. She has walked away. She turns and she makes that decision. And the other thing that I like that was threaded through this is both you realize and what, you know, what comes out, but very subtly is, oh, Louise was shooting someone else. Do you know what I mean? Like that she was carrying something.
Oh, yeah.
And that both of these women, you also get a sense that they are feeling guilt and trauma and remorse
entirety
of this. Like they start drinking, they do not stop drinking this whole movie. And they don't they don't bring it up in this like it's when they first had these first drinks at this honky tonk before this assault, that's fun. The rest of the time it is just
numbing.
A deadening. Right.
Yeah.
And having that in there, just they don't talk about, I just don't want my head, like, no. They are just drinking. You just see the act of it. It's that show, not tell thing.
And you know, Louise shoots the guy early on. Again, you're right. Not that guy, but some guy, all guys, you know. And then, but both of them at the end blow up that oil tanker. And again, it's like you could say, oh, this guy's individual, you know, sin is a small one. But it's like, no, this is a collected, this is a collective rage that has built up in them over a lifetime of being, you know, exploited, being abused, being, you know, condescended to. And it is, and at the end, it is literally exploding.
Yeah, I think that's great. And actually leads to my next question, because I think this is one of the first movies that really took on female rage. I mean, you know, one of the big ones we talked about last year, A Promising Young Woman, was so largely centered around the idea of this kind of impotent female rage needing an outlet. What do you guys think the legacy of Thelma and Louise is, like for movies, for women, for, you know, the characters that they're given?
Good question.
You're right.
I think it's the kind of movie that I wish had led to more films like it, and I don't know that it necessarily has. I think that so much of what we wind up getting are these sort of like women who kick ass, you know, which is not quite the same thing. I mean, I think I would see this maybe in a film like the aptly titled Revenge, where, you know, the woman who is sexually assaulted, like, hunts down and takes vengeance upon all the men that did it. Although that obviously has its roots in you know, I Spit on Your Grave and a lot of other sort of, you know, kind of post-slasher feminist films. I don't know that I can necessarily point to things, but I surely there must be.
But I agree. I mean, you know, that was the big thing at the time when this came out, and it did as well as it did. It made as much money as it did. Callie Khouri, I think didn't she win Best Screenplay?
She won Best Original Screenplay. Yeah.
At the Oscars. So like, this is a film that made a huge impact. And as such, it's one of those like, ugh, I'm sure we're going to see so many like women taking control, women on the road. And you're like, well, no, in like 10 more years, we got the Banger Sisters. But it wasn't like a huge cultural door opening to
it's sort of like how after Brokeback Mountain we thought, oh great, Hollywood studios want to make movies about gay relationships, and it turns out they did not.
I mean, to your point, Alonzo, like they make like an Atomic Blonde, or like last week Jolt came out on Amazon Prime, which is about a woman who's like literally shocking herself to like not let her rage, you know, go unchecked. But and I kind of liked it, but I know a lot of people didn't like it. But, you know, but what's missing is the friendship. And the friendship is so key to Thelma and Louise, because they fight, they spar with each other. They, you know, are loving. They take care of each other. They nurture each other. And like that the end where they like hold hands and they're like making this choice together. I mean, that's the part that I'm just like, yes, I just want to cheer for whatever, you know, what's happening, because it's their friendship. And we are seeing these badass women who are alone and they don't have friends. And like, that's really sad.
But and I mean, like the kiss, like the climax, there's a history of the climactic kiss in a movie, and the two female leads share it in this movie. And it's not like a sexual thing. It is about their friendship, and it is about that connection. And I think so often we have seen movies that are about male friendship, and there might be some women who kind of like drift in and out of the story, but are ultimately secondary to like this central kind of male thing. And we don't see that nearly as often with women. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It is their relationship that's the center of it all. And then, you know, and plus they throw some young Brad Pitt eye candy our way as well.
All right. So let's give our final reviews on Thelma and Louise. We are back to vaccinated status. Would you screen it, stream it, or skip it? Alonzo, I'll start with you so you can show us how it's done.
Oh, absolutely, screen it. You know, I don't necessarily regret not having watched it again in 30 years, but now that I have broken that seal, I will be watching it again and again in the years to come. But it absolutely, like, I think the whatever worries I had that it wasn't going to hold up, or that it's not going to be as great as I remember it, or it's not going to have the impact on me, I wept again at the ending. And so, yeah, I think this is a movie where there is so much dotted throughout, little character choices, little backstory moments, little, you know, the snow globe, all kinds of things like that. So I think it does merit from repeated viewing, and obviously from projected viewing when possible.
Nice. Katie, how about you?
Screen it, stream it, however you watch it. It's, I think, so delightfully rewatchable. There's so many great character moments, and it's entertaining as hell. The you know, it's a 2-hour, 9-minute movie. It the pace just rips. And the soundtrack's great. The cast is great. I love all the men who are cast. We talked about them a little bit, but like Christopher McDonald, he's
Michael
a horrible.
Madsen.
Michael Madsen is great. Yeah. Christopher McDonald, like, is so funny as like the worst person alive, and like I just adore his performance. But all of the guys are great. It's just everything, tip to tail, is perfect for me. So just watch it. However you get it, watch it. But if you can't screen it, yeah, totally
nice. Yeah. If
you, you know, I'm a big screen it, you know, check with your local, you know, art house theater that, you know, runs things. I mean, now it is the 30th, so maybe we'll get a few, you know, QT, where is it at the new B, huh?
Not enough. I'm gonna stop.
he's gonna run out of letters.
Yeah. But yeah, no, definitely. I would love to see this on the big screen for that like final shot. I feel like that's one of those once in a lifetime shot. Don't you ever cut away from a death white screen and then a, you know, throwback. I want to see it all the way through.
They do. I will say I do wish they held on that white screen for like a minute longer.
I know. It really just like goes like right into the.
It goes into some uplifting music right away. I was like, no, you guys are okay.
I'm still crying
with that white screen. Yeah. I am also a screen it, and hopefully there are many 30th anniversary screenings. There is definitely one in Bentonville, Arkansas. So if you're anywhere near, we're going to be doing it at the drive-in. It's
fine.
The drive-in in Bentonville. And then we did a interview with Gina and writer Callie Corey that we will be projecting as well. So, nice.
And if you can't get to Bentonville, it is currently streaming on the Criterion channel.
Yay! Criterion. Ooh. I think it's also on Hoopla.
Oh, nice.
Hoopla.
Hoopla.
And, all right. What's the other one that's not Tubi, but it's the other free watching?
Pluto?
I think it is Pluto. On Tubi. Pluto. I think it's on Tubi.
It's on Tubi as well.
With
but ads. When I saw it on Tubi, it said Spanish. So I went to Pluto. Even though I do have Criterion, but the Criterion is never on Decider, so sometimes I get faked out. I will say American Movie is also on Criterion now, and holy fuck. Love
Hold
that
it for staff picks, mister.
Oh my God, yes.
We have a way to do things. And yeah, I can't wait to hear you babble about that one. Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think about you the whole time I watch
it. I figured. We'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
I'm Judge John Hodgman.
And I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne.
10 years ago, I came on Jordan Jesse Go and judged my first dispute. Is chili a soup? It's a stew, obviously.
The judge has dispensed a decade of justice. He's the one person wise enough to answer the really important questions. Like, should you hire a mime to perform at your own funeral?
After they cry, I want them to laugh.
Do you really need a tank full of jellyfish in your den?
They smell like living creatures decaying.
Only if they are decaying.
Yeah, which they will be.
Real people, real justice, real comedy.
Winner of the Webby Award for Best Comedy Podcast.
The Judge John Hodgman Podcast, every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Drea Clark, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Katie Walsh.
And Iffy Wadiway.
Yay! So now is when I get to talk to my buddies about what's been taking over my past few months, the Bentonville Film Festival, led by Gina Davis, thus tying in with Thelma and Louise. We love a good theme here at Maximum Film. And I think not everybody may know outside of the industry, but one of the other things that's interesting to see Gina as Thelma is that Gina's become such a righteous force in the entertainment industry. She started the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media, and then obviously the film festival, and our entire focus on programming and in our conversations and the shape of everything is underrepresented voices. And this year, our lineup, our directors are 71% female, 70% by POC or AAPI, and 33% LGBTQIA+, or some exciting combination of all of those things. So it's really fun, and it translates on screen. And what I'm going to do is throw some of our movies at you and see what you guys think of them, if you've seen any of them. And a reminder that anyone who wants to watch these and check them out at Bentonville, you can look at them at our virtual festival and get 50% off the ticket price if you use the code MAXFILM when you get that, and then just watch it on your computer if you're me and don't know how to make those things work on your TV, or make it work on your TV if you're a little more advanced. So
what's the website, Drea?
It is bentonvillefilm.org. Thank you, Alonzo. I mean, look at, again, that was like a sports, like you passed me a ball, right? Sports, that's
the
our
assist.
Other theme today.
Let's say
assist.
Yes.
Thank you, Katie.
Okay, I know a sport term.
Yeah, you got it. So one of the films that we're showing out of competition, I was so psyched because the director made the news last week. It is a film called Mogul Mowgli, and it is starring and co-written and co-produced by Riz Ahmed. Many of you know him because he won an Academy Award this year for Sound of Metal. And in Mogul Mowgli, he is playing a British Pakistani rapper and who is faced with an illness. And so there are shades of similarities, but it is a whole different beast. He's sort of dealing a lot with his family, confronting his Muslim background. The director of that, who can tell me, what film was the director of Mogul Mowgli just attached to direct for Marvel?
Huh? Oh, gosh.
I have no idea.
It just came out last week.
Blade.
Blade. Yes.
Yes, I remember
correct.
That.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Because I always stand for my black queens.
There you go.
Blah, blah, blah. Also, we got to go back to the drawing board on BIPOC. We got to get it. We got to let it roll off the tongue better. I can say that. And I will say that.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
I can say that, and I will say that.
We also separated to AAPI. There's a whole thing of like making sure that, anyway.
Also, Riz Ahmed got an Oscar nomination this year.
Nomination. Oh, you're right. I just want to give everybody
right,
the award.
Oh, right, because
Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony won, yeah.
That's right.
But
nobody
also,
believes any
Riz
of the winners
Ahmed
this year.
Had a career as a rapper, so I'm super excited about
and
this.
And he is hot on stage, which is no surprise to anyone who's ever seen him.
Right.
He's a beautiful man. But yes, Bassam Tariq, who directed this, was just tapped to do the next Marvel movie, which
that's
is
so cool.
An extraordinary like leap from this one. But the kind of like, that's an exciting find. I love it. It's like the Cathy Yan doing the
Birds
Fantabulous
Birds of Prey or the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
Oh, yeah. God. That's why Alonzo's here, right? I stumble over a couple consonants and he picks it up. And you guys, he runs the ball to the end of the field. Yes,
I'm just here
continue.
To assist.
Touchdown.
Here to assist.
Yes. Okay. So what if I told you that I had a romantic comedy and it starred the girl who plays John Cena's daughter in Blockers and then the guy who plays the cab driver in Deadpool. And it's the two of them, and they are set up by their Indian mothers for like an arranged marriage sort of date. It goes wrong. They find out she is not very traditional. He very much is. And then the COVID lockdown hits literally at the end of their date. He gets stuck in her home for an unforeseeable amount of time. And you guys, the romantic comedy stuff all ensues.
That sounds so fun. I want to see that like tonight.
Right? It's called 7 Days. It's directed by Rashaan Sethi.
Is it Geraldine Viswanathan?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I love her. She's so
Sony.
Great. She's good in everything.
Yeah, I think this premiered at Tribeca this year, but it is not out in theaters yet. So on the festival circuit, Bentonville and elsewhere, the only place you can watch this film right now.
Indeed.
Oh, it sounds so fun.
Yeah. I love a good, I love a rom-com.
I love a rom-com.
Yeah.
I know.
No shame with that. We have Beans, which is a film by director Tracy Deer. It is through a crisis that she lived through in the 1990s in Canada. She was a young Mohawk girl and a town that is like under siege because of this whole uprising that's happening. And it's completely from the perspective of a young girl. It is this incredible cast of Indigenous and primarily female actresses, which I love. I love good exploring new talent. This was another Tribeca one. I don't know if either of you saw Catch the Fair one. It's produced, one of the producers is Molly Asher, who also produced a film called Nomadland this year.
Ah.
But this is a really, it's a much smaller, very intense film. And it stars a professional female boxer named Kelly Reese. And oh, cool. She is so badass. But it's like a dark thriller. And her younger sister has been kidnapped and might be sex trafficked. And she like goes off to like track her down and gets undercover. And did I mention she's like a badass boxer?
I want to see that one too tonight.
Yeah. Okay. This one blows my butt because you guys know that I taught at USC for like 13 years. And this is a film co-directed and starring one of my former students.
Oh, that's so cute.
Which is crazy to me. It's called I'm Fine, Thanks for Asking. It premiered at South by Southwest. Whoa, do you know Kelly?
I don't know Kelly. I saw that because my girlfriend did the art on the like food service program. The art for that was done by Molly. So I watched it at South by. I watched that Nuevo Rico.
You guys, look at this. Look at Iffy.
Hey, we're all coming together. I'm slowly becoming a Dreyer. Soon you'll come through me to get into Sundance. Soon it'll be.
You won't come through me because I have no power. But yes,
she has all the power. Soon she's gonna lie to you. Email us. God.
Yes, directed by Kelly Callie and Angelique Molina, and it is Kelly plays this young mother who is recently widowed and suddenly homeless because of the pandemic, and so it's her like trying to raise all this money in a day, but she literally roller skates across L.A. And it is somehow, I don't know how, it cannot be comfortable transportation. Like, do you guys have any? I could not.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think how far really I could roller skate. Like.
Okay. I can't roller skate. I would be done instantly. I'd be on the butt.
Yeah.
Instantly. I would get half a block.
My ankles are sore just having this conversation.
I know. But she definitely makes it seem so fun and easy. Oh, like, you almost are like, oh, maybe that is a form of transportation we should try.
No, she's such a good roller skater. And we're like friends on Facebook because that was the kind of teacher I was.
Oh,
and she always has like video clips of her roller skating. I did not know she was dovetailing that with a directing career. Kudos to Kelly. And then finally, for narratives, there's a director that I feel like Alonzo might know. I programmed shorts of hers at LA back in the day, Mari Walker. She had a great short called Swim. She's a transgender director who has like really beautiful incorporation of transgender characters and themes in her work.
I don't know that I know her work.
Okay. So the feature that we're showing at Bentonville is called See You Then. It stars Puya Moseni and Lin Chen, and they are a couple that dated 15 years ago, and this all takes place in one night when they come back together. And one of the big things they're dealing with is one of them has transitioned since their love affair. And so they're sort of like working through all of the reasons that their relationship fell apart, which are a little different than the reasons other people's might. So I think Mari has such a beautiful eye for things and really nice, you know, walk and talk, relationshipy stuff.
I love it when a shorts filmmaker, you know, gets to make the big jump up to feature. So good honor.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, that's just a taste of what we have. We also have this great lineup of shorts and episodics and all sorts of things. The features are obviously my particular section, so what's close to my heart. But I really love our films and our filmmakers.
They all sound so good.
Oh, good.
I want to like make a list of all of them, make them on my watch list.
The good thing is they are listed all right on bentonville.film.org. But yes, I hope it would be very fun for me if people check these out. We spend a lot of time I spend all year looking for them and then looking through our submissions and arguing them out.
And what's that promo code again, Drea?
Thank you, Alonzo, for the assist. I remembered my sports term. Promo code for 50% off is MAXFILM, all capital letters.
Nice.
Woo.
All right.
Nice.
Okay, so thank you all. You journeyed with me to Arkansas very nicely, and I'm very grateful for it. But now it's time to bring you back into the mix. So I would love to hear your staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Iffy, we're going to start with you.
Well, you know, you already got a spoiler earlier. It's going to be American movie. It's currently on Criterion. You know, speaking of Molly, who worked on the film, apparently she never saw it. And I just, I was like, I'm not even going to explain it to you because she was on her way out. I was like, I'm going to just force you to watch the first 10 minutes. And that's everything you need to know about this movie. So, of course, she definitely wants to see it. But if you haven't, it's about this filmmaker, Mark, is Borchardt. Thank you. Drea led me astray by shaking her head. Yes.
Oh, Alonzo, sorry. I was just like letting the flow go.
But yeah, Mark Borchardt, who is an aspiring filmmaker, out of Wisconsin, and he really just wants to make great films. And you really get to see inside of his philosophy on filmmaking and going through. And I think it's just anybody who's ever tried to make a film or anybody who's tried to shoot anything ever will just just get so much fun out of it. But if you do none of that, it's this beautiful, heartwarming film about like someone who really wants to make something great, but is just not great at it and is surrounded by a whole bunch of people who are not making it better. It is.
If you're ever wondering what Wisconsin can be like, have we got the movie for you?
Yes. Oh, man. Every time I watch it, it just reminds me of whenever Drea does her Midwestern voice. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is it. This is
where it
this
comes
is
from.
It. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. American movie. Yeah, it's a great one. That's a classic, Iffy. I love that you brought that up.
Yeah, that's exactly how everyone sounds like.
Uh-huh. Alonzo.
Oh, okay.
We'll let the gents go first. Katie and I'll headline
there you
this
go.
One.
You'll drive off the cliff at the end. Well, when I was watching Thelma and Louise on Criterion Channel, I saw that they do these double features of different films, and they had paired it with Greg Araki's The Living End. And I thought, oh, that's kind of brilliant, because it's also a road movie, but it's about two gay men who are HIV positive in the early 90s and who are sort of at odds and ends, and one of them may or may not have killed a homophobe, and so they're sort of on the lam and sort of just not sure what to do with themselves or where their lives are going to continue, because obviously in 1991 having an HIV positive a diagnosis was a much, you know, more serious and deadly affair than it is now, thanks to advances in medicine. It has a very, you know, it's lean and sparse, but it's very angry, and so was I when I saw it in 1991, and it's a film that I think holds up as a really interesting kind of snapshot of that moment. It is like Thelma Louise, but it is its own thing very much entirely. But it is one of the highlights of the new queer cinema, and if you've never seen it, you absolutely should. Greg Araki's The Living End.
Nice. I mean, I did not expect us to have a Mark Borchard Greg Araki day, and this is exciting. All right, Katie, give me your hand.
All right,
let's do this.
I am just gonna go with something I saw last night. It's contemporary. It's coming out this weekend. It is David Lowery's The Green Knight, starring Dev Patel. I really enjoyed this movie. Didn't really know what to expect going in. And it was interesting because I saw it at the Draft House, and David Lowery had a little short video explaining kind of his favorite films, his influences. And so it was like Bram Stoker's Dracula, The Dark Crystal, Willow, what were the other ones? I have it on my phone somewhere. But it was like all these like high fantasy movies that were really important to him. And The Passion of Joan of Arc, which is a great silent film if you've never seen it. And Marie Antoinette, Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette. And it was really interesting thinking about those influences as I was watching the movie. And also, like, I didn't totally know what was going on. It's like a very symbolic film. I ran into a guy afterwards who was like really talking to me a lot about the medieval poem that it's based on. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about, bro. I was just like, Dev Patel is very sexy. And this whole movie is about how he's very sexy and a lot of people want to fuck him. And I was like, yeah, I can get into this, like, capes and foxes and just like, who the hell knows what the plot is kind of thing. I mean, it's like there's a simple plot that you can obviously understand, but then there's all this witchery and Freudian stuff going on and spirits that he's encountering. And it's like a good, interesting, weird movie. And I think it's an interesting sort of like summer blockbuster. So definitely check it out.
I can't wait to see that. I love David Lowery. I loved Ain't These Bodies Saints. I love Ghost Story.
Yeah.
But you know what? His Pete's Dragon was rad.
Yeah, like, and he loves those movies. His Pete's Dragon, of course, is like inspired by all those like 80s fantasy.
The original Pete's Dragon, you're okay not revisiting.
Yeah, not so much.
I gave that to my friend when her kid was born, and she was like, "Have you watched this recently?" And I was like, "No, but I loved it when I was little." She's like, "It is not good." All right, mine is also a recent film, because that's what Katie and I do up here in the front seat of this Thunderbird. It is written and directed by Edson Oda. It was a Sundance film. It's called 9 Days. It is coming out this weekend as well. It stars Winston Duke, which many of you knew from Black Panther or from Us, as well as Zazie Bates, Benedict Wong, Tony Hale, Bill Skarsgård. It is a supernatural drama. It's a pre-birth. It's basically a man, Winston Duke's character, is interviewing five unborn souls to determine which one will be given life on Earth. So they're going through and kind of getting into all of this metaphysical stuff, but it is not like a punishment for life poorly lived. It is people who have not yet left. So like there's fun stuff. Yeah. A lot to dig on. And I enjoy that kind of movie. So 9 days. All right. That is it. We did it. I got us here. I'm going to park this thing at the edge of the cliff and let us all safely out of the doors. Katie, I adore you. Thank you so much for being here.
This is so fun. I love visiting the Maximum Film crew. Thank you guys for having me.
Do you have anything you want to plug? How can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter, Katie Walsh STX. And if you search my name, Katie Walsh, on Rotten Tomatoes, you can find my Rotten Tomatoes reviews. I review for the Tribune News Service and the LA Times, and occasionally have other little pieces around the web. But yeah, just find me on Twitter and I post all my stuff there. So, you know, yeah, come hang out.
All right. Alonzo and Iffy, you guys are my guys. I love you so much.
Yeah, one thing I'll say before we get out, because I should have added it to my What's Good, but I am a founding member of Vidiots, Friends of the Pod. And right now, Ryan Johnson, along with Karina Longworth, is matching up to 100K in donations. So make sure you donate. It's literally around the corner for me. So I will, like, that's why it's the bonus, because it's really close to me. It's a cool space. And I'm super excited that it is no longer on the West Side. you know.
So once Vidiots opens, you can go there and stalk Iffy in one easy trip.
Yes. Yes, actually you can. And I promise to be wearing the crop top that I'm wearing right now.
I donated. I'm so excited for Vidiots to open as well. And it's just such a cool space. And it's going to be a video store and a hangout spot and a movie theater and all kinds of fun stuff is going to happen.
Oh, yeah. You want physical media. They got your physical media
here. Yes, indeed.
Nice. Okay. So if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/group/maximumfilm, or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer, lovely and cranky, is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.